Channel. This is a Class 1 emergency. All civilian traffic is barred from streets and highways. Stay in your homes. Stay in your homes.
Live from the Benbrook Studio in Uptown, USA, it's Necro Nanopod, your space level in the Kankara, episode 66. F.G. Kadam's House of Lost Souls. The story of a man who liked a girl.
Funny when they do those shows and the hosts always they go to commercial and then like we're back. Well, what? Why do you have to say anything? We know that.
Yeah.
We know that they're back.
We're here.
Seeing them.
Yeah, we're here because we know you're here. And if we weren't here, we wouldn't care. And if we probably just don't care anyway.
It seems like a throwback to some bygone. Well, it's era of broadcasting.
Yeah, live broadcasting.
Yeah,
things like that. Yeah, but anyway, we're not back. We were here the whole time. And like I said, in sleep mode.
But we were in a pool with our other pod mates.
Exactly.
Just putting books downloaded into our head.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's like our pool with other podmates. Where are you going with
Minority
this?
Report. Oh, I was predicting the future of crimes.
Anyway, so we read a good book this time. Or did we?
All right, you open up. I think it's one of those things. You can turn it one way and say it's a good book, and you can turn it another way and say this is a piece of crap.
Oh, wow. I thought it was pretty good. I thought it was pretty good. I don't. For some reason, we haven't ended up reading a lot of sort of haunted house ghost stories like this.
Yeah.
And I really, honest to God, thought this was going to be like a Scooby-Doo story where they go in the house and you know have to spend the night or something like that. And
it's it had elements of that.
It had elements of that, but it was very much.
It was a mystery.
It was a mystery. Yeah.
But it was very gothic.
It was very gothic. The author's plotting was pretty sophisticated. You don't get that so often in horror, where it's pretty linear. One thing happens and the next thing happens. This one starts in the middle, and then you get huge flashbacks and nested narratives and things like that.
Yeah,
which could be a little confusing, but and actually it was actually because I was listening to it and it was kind of confusing at times. But you know once you get a good hold of it and know where everything fits, it makes a really interesting story. It's an interesting way to tell a story.
Yes. Yes and no.
And no. Well, I know why you agree with me, but why do you disagree?
It's interesting because I mostly listened to the book, but I was getting impatient. To get through, because I felt like the reader was going way too slow, so I went to the library and got the book and finished off the last. I was already at the end.
You were pretty much at the end.
So I finished it myself, and being able to look at the book, the inside of the book, you could see where different fonts were used, like for Pandora's diary, and so that stuff was clearer. It was confusing sometimes. So, who was the narrator?
Yeah,
and when in time you were. And I think that's a problem with the author, of course. I think that's a problem because I don't think it should be that confusing.
Oh, you are not going to like that book piece that I gave you. Because the time shifts happen and you don't even know that they're happening.
But
you're gonna yell.
But isn't that book about things like that?
It's about a guy with Alzheimer's. Kind of.
I mean, that would make, yeah. But that makes sense. This yeah. isn't a book about that.
No, it's so. Not. Or is it?
I don't remember. What are we talking about? War yeah, and Peace? Right.
Yeah. You're stealing my stuff.
I overall did enjoy it. I do think there were some things that could have been cut out of it. And
I would agree with that.
Yeah. I was much more intrigued with Pandora's story than I was with anything else in that book, and I wish that would have been the book.
Exactly.
The whole book.
It's kind of funny. I had that same reaction when I was, because you know, I was sort of interested in the main character's story, Seton. I was actually kind of enjoying all the 80s nostalgia. of course, you know, it's not my nostalgia. I wasn't in London in the 80s, but.
Madison is the London of
it's the London of
the Midwest.
The Midwest. Well, it really is.
Blimey.
but when you start getting these frame tales, I mean, that's a frame tale, and you sort of get these tales within the tales. And so the one that was the most disorienting for me was, you know, so he. You know, goes and meets this mercenary whose sister has been affected by the Fisher House, and suddenly you're in freaking Africa in the Congo, mm-hmm. Dealing with some sort of like African demon, and I'm like, this is very far from the Fisher House right now, and it didn't occur to me that they were going to try to tie that in until later. I just thought,
yeah,
well,
nothing is left unused.
Yeah, nothing is left unused in this story. Even the characters that you just think are sort of throwaway characters, like the priest that he runs into there in Africa, shows up again and again, and turns out to be key.
I thought it was I was listening to the book. And I don't know if it was because of the British accent or whatever it was, but I thought it was quite a feat that I felt like I was listening to something that was gothic in the sense of being turn of the century, even when it was taking place in the 1980s.
Yeah, that's
1990s. I felt like I'm listening to a timepiece.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's the right word. But, and it's like I have to shake my head and be like, oh no, this is fairly contemporary.
Yeah.
At least
yeah,
I lived in that era.
Yeah.
But it felt out of time that way, even though time was constantly referenced.
Yep.
Musically and mm-hmm. you know, the Seton sort of life and going back in time and
yep.
It's but it did feel it felt and I thought that was pretty interesting that he was able to pull that off.
Yeah, no, it was pretty sophisticated. It reminds me of, and I wonder if this is the case of turn of the century and 19th century ghost stories. I haven't read very many of them, probably are, you know, just sort of supernatural stories. But what, you know, one of the most famous is Dracula, which I have read, and that does that. It's not as.
I could not help but think of Dracula reading this book,
really,
because he does the same conventions.
Mm-hmm.
You're reading a diary.
Yep.
Which was pretty well written for a diary. That was my other quibble. Was like,
she was very well educated.
She was well educated, and she was like, "Wow, whose diary has complete thoughts in it?" I mean, you know, it was very complete. Like
mine does. It says, "This is the diary of Mike Stuffel," and that's pretty much where it ended.
It was reading like a novel, and you're like,
I know.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that's the convention.
That's the convention.
That's what they did in Dracula, and
yeah,
I thought a lot of that.
Yeah, no. There was once or twice when I thought, you know, this is the way that they're finding these diaries and the information that they get from the diary, and he finds a second diary that sort of continues the story. Pandora's second diary.
Right.
And I just thought, you know, I'm going to choose not to think about that too much because it's total bullshit. It stretches credulity.
It does. But the whole thing did.
So. Well, yeah, of course. But the But you know, those looping tales where, you know, you sit down and, you know, for 20, 30, 40, 50 pages, you're suddenly back in the 70s with Gurkha mercenaries in the Congo, or you're in the trenches of World War I, or you're in this, you know, the original Fisher House, the incidents that happened there in the 30s with, you know, famous people, Aleister Crowley and Hermann Göring, and I never did bother to look up to see if any of the other people were real.
Wheatley's real.
Like Dennis Wheatley is real.
Yeah, he's real.
Really?
Yeah.
That is awesome.
There's a lot about him, actually.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to have to click around and find out more about that.
Oh, yeah, well, I think he was a well-known Satanist.
Well-known Satanist.
Or witch coven or something.
Cool.
Because I just got off this hypnosis training.
Mm-hmm. Are you hypnotized right now?
I've been in a trance for 2 weeks.
Nice.
See my arm. Why does my arm keep levitating? I'm raising my arm. Erickson, who is the founder of the method that I studied,
mm-hmm.
His preferred way of working with people is that he would induce a trance.
Okay.
And then, you know, all the things you do around that to deepen that. But when he got to the part of sort of the therapy, he would tell stories.
Okay.
And his way of telling stories was to start one story and then loop into another story out of that story and then loop into another story and never really finish and then come back around and finish stories.
Sure.
And I couldn't help. I just kept thinking of that when I was reading this book.
Yeah.
That same. And it's supposed to be doing something to your unconscious or your subconscious, which is more profound than if in your kind of waking rational mind.
Yeah.
It's sort of, it's getting in there more. Yeah. And
of course Scheherazade did the same thing.
Yeah.
Never finished the story to keep her neck, her head attached to her body.
Well, the stories would get finished, but there was a reason for starting one, starting another, looping back and completing and maybe telling a little bit more of the first one, a little bit more.
Yep.
So, and that's exactly what this guy did.
Yeah.
So, which I think has to be the case, because whether I really like the book or not, stuff about it feels very, like I was dreaming about the bones of little Peter in a bag, and they kept showing up, and I kept digging graves and burying them, and they'd show up again.
Wow.
Yeah, and I never have dreamed about a book like that before.
Damn. And that's pretty great.
Yeah.
Poor little Peter.
And that, to me, was the heart. I was grabbed by that.
Yeah.
He did that well.
He did that very well. And like you were saying, it's some of those, you know, he takes the time to develop what are otherwise like really, you think to be like minor characters, like, you know, he's not going to make us really know this little boy because, you know, that'd be too painful, but then he does.
You do know him.
And same thing with Pandora, you know, you get her story just in fits and starts and little bits here and there, but it's really sad. It's really sad that she gets stuck in this bad situation and makes a stupid choice to get herself on this island, and everything else after that is just trying to atone for it. And the little boy story is really awful.
It's really awful.
It's awful. And you know, to hear them like rationalize, you know, that he's not even a person. He's just.
He's just rickets.
He's human. Yeah, he's human garbage, you know. No one's going to miss him. Ugh. I don't know.
Yeah, and to find out that he was destined to be...
Yeah, that he was kind of brilliant. He was doing calculus at age...
Eight?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, that was a good trick. He, Jikatam does a pretty good job of making you feel all of these characters. Another kind of a minor character, Lucinda, the narrator's girlfriend back in the 80s.
Yeah.
When you find out that she's dead,
Well, is she?
Well, yeah, exactly. You don't know.
You don't really know.
But you hear this. You hear this story. Her ghost narrating what happened to her after they split up. And actually, there's a little overlap where, you know, the night that she tried heroin for the first time, he sees her and she seems kind of dreamy that night, and he doesn't think much of it. But it turns out that was the time, that was the day that she, you know, started doing dangerous drugs and was to die, or maybe not. We don't know.
Yeah, because at that point in the story, you don't know if he's being manipulated by something or if these things actually happen.
Yeah. So I, you know, in the end, I really enjoyed this story. I have to say, at the very end, that the big buildup was a bit of a disappointment.
Yes, it was.
It was kind of a disappointment.
That's my second quibble with the book, is that first I had to reread it. It's like, what just happened?
I know.
And then talking about pulling a rabbit out of a hat.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, where is this coming from?
Yeah, it was.
Could he not think of an ending? And
it really suffers from that. I think, you know, the lead up to this big thing, you know, he does a really good job of building the dread of the forces that are at play here and what's going to happen when he finally goes back to the Fisher House. And then when you get there, it's not as disappointing as the end of The Last Gunslinger book.
Yeah, but it's on par.
it was a little disappointing. It was
Well, actually, I liked the ending of The Last Gunslinger, so I was okay with that. After you've been through ten books or whatever it was.
With the Crimson King throwing water balloons of fire at Roland and his company.
Yes, I'm fine with that.
Okay, well, you know.
No, the tower. I was just thinking he goes into the tower. The dark tower. There's like a rose or something, and then he starts all over again.
It loops over again, yeah. I didn't like that at all.
Oh, I didn't mind that.
That's all right.
I'm probably more Hindu than you are.
Yeah, well, no, I've read that. That's a trick that writers do. And
what do you mean it's a trick that writers do?
So it's James Joyce did it. I think he was the first person to do it with Finnegan's Wake, where the end of the book literally the end of the last the book doesn't end the last sentence doesn't end. It runs right into the first sentence of the book, and so so theoretically you can start the book anywhere.
Yeah.
And it'll just keep going around and around and around.
Yeah.
It's all right. It's a creative writing seminar trick.
Sure, but
anyway,
even ending a book is a trick.
I know,
right?
We may have digressed a bit. This was kind of disappointing. I wonder,
because this wasn't even that.
No,
the ending wasn't even that. It was somehow he had magical powers all along.
It's like he's built this gigantic this beginnings of this gigantic structure like on a table or something like that, and you're gonna wonder how he's gonna build the last few layers. And instead of building those last layers, he just sort of sweeps the whole thing off the table.
Yeah, I mean, talk about Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it really comes out of nowhere.
It kind of comes out of nowhere. Yeah, I was so disappointed. When I got confused earlier in the book, I would go back, I would skip back, you know, 20, 30, 40 minutes of reading time, and I would just re-listen to it. And I would pick up the thread again, that was actually very helpful. But when I got to the end of the book, I thought, you know what? That didn't make any sense, and I'm kind of pissed, and I'm not going to go back and listen to that again.
I did. I went back. I reread it three times.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I was like, just those last few pages, like, what happened?
Yeah.
And there's nothing. The thing that bugged me about it is that there was nothing that I could think of in the rest of the book that alluded to that ability.
Yeah. Yeah. Except,
you know, except he says, well, he crossed the river and, you know, hypnotically, you know, he forgot. He was made to forget.
Yeah.
But that he went, that he stopped the demon, and then he went back and looked in his face, and that's when he sort of lost his mind.
Mm-hmm.
But really nothing in the book before that alludes to these powers.
There's one thing that does, and he does this over and over again. You find out over and over again that every person who seems to be getting bought together by chance are not being bought together by chance. There are greater forces at work, and his particular role is ambiguous. You don't know exactly what it is until the very end, when it suddenly, you know, pops the power. But you are led to believe that everyone is at where they're supposed to be for a reason, besides, you know, the author managing the plot.
See, it felt more like the author managing the plot
than something that the character was doing
to create his own luck. You know?
Exactly. Then that is a failure.
Yeah.
That is a failure.
But I just felt, I just chalked that up to convention.
Yeah.
The convention of ghost stories, you know.
Mm-hmm. So there's one part that I really, really enjoy, and it kind of keys into, maybe it goes a little further on a point that we've talked about before. It was the story of Monsignor Lafarge. Is that his name? Something or other?
We can call him that.
We'll call him the Monsignor. And he's talking about his conversion experience. And he's converted not by God, but he's converted by Satan.
Mm-hmm.
That got me to think. Because normally, we've harped on this before about how sometimes it pisses me off when horror stories resort cheaply to supernatural reasons for people doing bad, when there's plenty of evidence that people can do bad all by themselves. But in this one, it got me thinking that one of the reasons, you know, so anyway, the story is that this priest, he's in the...
they already know the story.
Yeah, they know. Of course you know the story. So in the trenches, he meets Dennis Wheatley and realizes that Dennis Wheatley is evil.
He's an abomination.
He's an abomination. Yeah, he's made some deal with the devil. And up until then, the priest had been having very hard time with his vocation. He does not believe in God. Or he's having a hard time believing in God. His doubts are overrunning him. And when he sees, not God, but he sees the devil at work in the world, then he believes in God. And so what I was thinking is that maybe that's one of the reasons that that we enjoy horror fiction, is that we find evidence of transcendent powers, not indirectly, by seeing how much evil, by looking at evil, you get to sort of imply that there's transcendent good as well.
Really?
I don't know.
I don't.
It was just something. It was just something I was thinking of as I was biking to work one day, listening to it.
But do you?
I don't know, but it got me thinking about it.
Well, what's your best guess?
My best guess?
I mean, I'm talking about you
me personally. I don't. But if that argument can be made, and I think it can for some people, that would explain, for instance, why that new run of supernatural Christian horror novels by Ted Dekker.
Christanatural. Christanatural.
Jesunatural. are part of the reason why they're so popular is because... believers read it for descriptions of the forces of evil, and are reinforced in their belief of the forces of supernatural good.
I think the idea of a binary is a pretty constructed reality.
Oh yeah.
So that just because, you know, you can't have, you know, God without evil or evil without God. Yeah. You just constructed a binary that, because there's plenty of evil things where there might not be anything redeeming whatsoever happening ever. You know, because this book could have easily ended with the main character being dead.
Yeah.
It would have been more true to the book, I think, that he
Yeah, the sense of menace that he sets up, it would seem truer to the fear that, I mean, actually, there were some genuinely spooky bits.
Yes, there was. That was the other thing about the book I liked.
Yeah.
I was gripped.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And the ending, working out as it did, kind of defanged those moments a little bit.
How so?
Well, just because the spooky, that sense of dread, retrospectively, it's just not as dreadful because it can be defeated.
I don't know if I understand what you're saying.
Well, you know, there are people who prefer their horror not to have a happy ending. Zombie aficionados, particular.
All Night of the Living Dead.
Exactly. Where the bad forces is just, you know, that shiver you get just looking at unstoppable forces of, you know, forces of destruction, and that your best efforts, all of your good impulses, are for naught because evil or destruction just does not care.
Well, yeah, you could say that it's more that it's the effort itself is the good, and whether it turns out well or not isn't the point, right?
Absolutely, yeah. That's a higher order way of approaching these movies and books. I was going to say another way for me to come at this is that why the ending was disappointing is that because the actual exact nature of the menace is unknown. It's as bad as anything that you can think of. And when he actually makes the nature of the bad known, it also kind of, because nothing that, you know, what Fritz Lang once said is, there's nothing that I can show you that is as bad as what you can make up in your own mind. And so in his movies like M, he would just suggest things. You know, he never showed Peter Lorre abducting the little girls. He would just show the balloon and the wires.
I think that's an interesting point, because I'm wondering then, how would you, if you were going to write this, mm-hmm. how would you have, because there has to be the clash, there has to be a climax, right?
Mm-hmm.
So is the climax that you're somehow, because you know something's been spawned or whatever mm-hmm. they called mm-hmm. it in the book.
Yeah.
So would you have still kept that fairly in the script? I mean, you still don't really get it, what it is, you know?
You don't.
You hear sounds, and they think they're hooves, and
yeah.
it takes on this form of this boxer,
or
at least suggests it, and it has an eye that you can
hit.
So, I mean, how else do you keep that menace vague, and yet, he does do it in... You know, so Seton goes to the house.
Yep.
You know, you get this feeling, right? Because the sun is setting. So he's setting the clock
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
the sun is setting. You're like, oh shit, he's going to be caught in the house and it's going to be dark. And he is.
Yeah.
And then he goes up these stairs. So these little, you know, he's here and then he has to go up the stairs. It's also very hypnotic.
Uh-huh.
He goes up the stairs. He gets the key, he opens the door, there's a mirror, he's looking in the mirror, he sees things, and he runs with all his might, and he falls down the stairs, you know, so he's picking at the board, because he knows the film is under there, right?
Yes.
That's why he's there, and he knows it's under there,
uh-huh.
and then here comes this thing. You know, ba-dum, 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 and he's running down the stairs, and he falls, and he gashes his knee, and he's stumbling at the house, and this thing is at his back, right? And you really don't know what it is.
Which is great.
You know, and you hear the voice of Pandora,
uh-huh.
Peter, just wait here.
Uh-huh.
And you know he's being fucked with at that point.
Yep.
And then he gets to that river, and it rips the pack off his back.
Yep.
And he runs across the river, and then he wakes up 7 hours later or whatever.
30 hours later.
Right. So there's all these things happening, but you don't quite know what it is. It keeps shifting.
Yeah, that was very effective.
It was very effective.
Yeah, it was great.
So that's in the middle of the book, yes. Right? Or can you do that at the end of a book? Can you do that at the climax? Can you keep it that vague writing?
I think you can. It doesn't have to be as vague. I mean, you can leave there with more.
I don't know if vague's the right word.
Just hallucinatory.
It's more abstract or impressionist.
But I mean, you have to give the reader something more.
You have to,
but you can't give him everything. You don't have to give them everything. And, you know, not that he does, but it just seemed to, the ending seemed a little too pat.
I thought that this thing sort of takes on the persona of this boxer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Seemed like he, like, what?
It's like, is he going to, like, have a boxing match now?
And, like,
but no,
this boxer only kind of shows up in Pandora's story, and it's not showing up in the rest of the Seton story, really.
Except that Seton is a boxer. Or he was a boxer. He's an amateur boxer.
I don't know. I thought it was
a little dumb. And the way it gets used is that he simply gives Mason a little bit more information about how to deal with the demon. He's like, oh, if he's this boxer, he's blind in his right eye. So come at him from that direction.
Right, it was very MacGyver-y.
Quick.
Oh, yeah, that'll work.
Yeah, quick, give me some copper wire and a box of Bisquick. We'll solve this problem.
I have to say the ending reminded me of The Neverending Story.
Oh, I've never read that story.
Did you ever see the movie?
Nope.
So in the end, you know, there's this darkness that's coming. Uh-huh. And sort of, what is it? It's entropy, basically. And it's sort of swallowing up everything. And everything gets swallowed up. But the belief of a one little boy, his imagination. Well, actually, it's a beautiful story.
I'm sure.
But everything gets recreated again. Uh-huh. And it was sort of felt like that kind of thing. Like, if I just close my eyes and
click your heels together and three then, times.
You know, the magic will come out of the bag. And, it deserved more than that.
Yeah.
And Seton still could have had this.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been better if he would have because how come he discovers it all of a sudden? Like, where's the impulse for that as well? I mean,
for him to discover everything at the end, or just to get involved at all?
No, that moment where he discovers, like, oh, I have this power within me.
Oh, yeah.
Like, where did that even come from? Did it come from somewhere? Or did I miss it?
I'd have to, you know. It might be worth giving it a reread to find out if there are any indications. I'm guessing, you know, this author is pretty careful. I'm guessing that he seeded hints in the book now and again, once or twice. Because this author, I felt as though, until the very end, I thought I was in really good hands. It was a pretty sophisticated piece of literary writing. Reasonably sophisticated, but also really, you know, engrossing and exciting and scary, and it was kind of what I look for in a really good horror novel, and this was one of them. I'm happy to see that he has a couple others out there. I might have to pick one or two of those up.
Mm-hmm, I would.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm very glad I just, you know, discovered this guy. It's his first novel,
we'll see. It can only get better,
or much, much worse.
Or it can get worse.
Yeah. You know, once he begins
mediocre.
Once the nightmare descent into pills and booze starts, you know.
Well, and I kind of wish he would write the Pandora story, the whole Pandora story.
That would be lovely.
How she got involved in all that.
Yep. Yep.
Because there's something kind of creepy about that era with Crawley, and that whole sort of he does a nice explanation of it.
Yeah,
know, sort of this response to the modern era was this kind of resurgence of magic and kind of that twisted, and it kind of plays into the grossly wealthy.
Yep.
I wonder if there's a similar things going on right now with the early 21st century robber barons. All these dissipated, you know, jillionaires and their children, you know, jetting off to various islands and participating in the dark arts, sacrificing, you know, children.
Supposedly, how you would define dark arts? I think it'd be more like sexual. It has that weird sexual.
Yeah.
That weird,
yeah.
The lady sticking the cigar in her vagina.
Yeah. Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah. I know that was. Yeah.
There's all that twisted stuff.
I know, and there's nothing
called the internet.
Yeah, and there's nothing that makes a twisted sex scene more twisted than by adding a few Nazis.
Right.
Yeah.
Nazis.
You got Aleister Crowley, Hermann Göring, Dennis Wheatley, apparently.
I don't think Crowley was a Nazi, was he?
No, but he was. He was my from what I know about him, he was pretty much exactly the way he was described in this book.
Well, there's that scene where that little boy, the young Mr. What's-His-Name, when Pandora comes in with Crowley into the shop, and Crowley looks like he's almost floating.
Uh-huh.
And then as he's walking out the door, he turns to a little boy and kind of sticks his tongue out kind of in this lewd manner.
Yep.
That was just creepy stuff.
He was a really, really creepy dude. Really creepy dude. maybe we'll put that stuff. Actually, I have a real good idea what the song is going to be at the end of this cast. I'll give it to you.
But I was haunted by this book in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So.
It's. I wonder. You know, this is a book I've never read, and I know you have. I wonder if this book reminded you at all of Peter Straub's Ghost Story.
You know, I read it so long ago, I don't remember.
Yeah, because my sense is like, I'm talking out of school here, but my sense is that Ghost Story is about this terrible thing that happened years and years ago, and that the negative energy of that keeps revisiting people who were involved, or and its resolution until it gets resolved in some way, you know, spiritually resolved. But I wonder if that story is sort of loops back and forth like this one does, because, you know, Peter Straub is a pretty sophisticated writer too, and he can manage multiple storylines and timelines and things like that. So
it reminded me a lot more of Stir of Echoes. Because
I saw that movie not too long ago.
And the book I read the book first. Where Seton is digging up that body and collecting those bones, and it's something about you have to find this body, you have to, because whatever evil is happening here is because this thing has been laid to rest in unhallowed ground.
Sure.
Basically.
Yeah.
And you know, and that was just again, he kind of set the clock on that one too, and he has it sort of starts to break the spell.
Mm-hmm.
And he's holding onto this bag for dear life.
Yeah. I wonder if that, you know, it's sort of that impulse, you know, that people talk about, you know, how they need closure, and that how that gets expressed, that, you know, that need and necessity for closure, it gets expressed in horror novels, is that, you know, you need to be, you know, the story needs to be, you know, you need to know what the truth is, what actually happened, the bones need to be buried properly.
Mm-hmm.
Someone needs to find out.
Yeah, you have to find the body buried under the cement in the basement, and
to get that closure, which, you know.
Well, that's a classic ghost thing, because why do the ghosts come back?
Yeah, unquiet spirits.
Yeah, except that's not why most of these ghosts are back.
No.
You know, the ones that though we haven't even mentioned those scenes, that, you know, Seton keeps seeing these scenes.
Yes.
Taking place, and never really quite knows what they are.
Yeah. Sees Pandora's
thing. In his story, he does know what they are when you get into the present, and he knows the bell's tolling and these things happening.
Yep.
But before that, there are these things, and because you know that part of the story first,
you can recognize what
he's not recognizing, and that There's Aleister Crowley in the bathroom. Yeah. In his spats and top hat.
His muddy spats and top hat. So this is a good read. This is a good read. Trying to think if I have anything else.
You're acting like you don't have anything more to say about it.
I don't know. I finished it a couple days ago. I read a whole other book since then. Well, not a whole other book, but half of another book, which we'll talk about later. I don't know. What do you got?
What else do I got? I got. All I got is that he has three more stories in there that he could actually write.
Yeah.
About he could write the priest story. There's probably a whole book in there.
Exactly.
He's got what's his name? Matt Madison or whatever his name is.
Mason.
Mason. There's a story there. He's got Pandora's whole story.
Yep.
I know what I was going to mention. I think the other thing we're kind of leaving out is this really the antagonist.
Mm-hmm.
Who's the son of Fisher's son.
Yes.
And there's that horror of him coming into Seton's life when he's had a breakdown.
Right.
And using him and psychoanalyzing him and getting into his head. So I think the thing I appreciated about this book was that it was lots of different genres,
mm-hmm.
because of that sort of psychological terror that people have. I'm telling you these things about myself. What are you going to do with them? Because now you know things about me, and you may even know things about me that I don't know.
Uh-huh.
And are you going to use those to hurt me or help me?
Yeah.
And here he was being manipulated by all of this.
Yep.
Yep. So that's a whole other way of a whole other genre of book.
Yeah.
And you got the ghost stories, and you've got this supernatural story, and you've got these things about fate, and
mm-hmm.
And I found that sort of terrifying too, when he discovers that I was at my most vulnerable, and here was this person
who was absolutely not looking up.
I had a very Rosemary's Baby feeling to it too, you know, this sort of once you get inside somebody's head, you're screwed, dude.
Yeah, it's like don't let Dr. Lecter get inside your head. You do not want him in there.
But I thought that the antagonist was fairly weak.
Honestly,
as he's I have matches and crying.
I do have to agree.
Yeah. And going, what a waste of power. It just sounded so. Now Fisher would have been
interesting.
Would have been a more interesting antagonist than his son.
Yeah.
If Fisher had somehow come back.
I was just thinking that we have read a book. There was another book that we have read for the Necronomicon Pod that also reminded me of this, and that was John Ferris's All Heads Turn When the Hunt Goes By.
Mm-hmm.
That was also heavily plotted book where lots of loops back in time and
mm-hmm.
Several continents being involved and different characters coming together as if by fate toward a big climax. So I would loop this one in with that, and that was also a very good book. So
mm-hmm. All right, so cocktail time.
I believe we should have some cocktails.
All right. What are we drinking here? This fruity, this ladies' drink. It feels like we're drinking a ladies'
drink. Is so effervescent and bubbly. What we're drinking here is a pink gin champagne cocktail. Pretty easy to make. You just get a champagne flute or something like that, and put in a little bit of sugar cube at the bottom. Hit it with a couple of dashes of bitters, Angostura bitters, and then a shot of gin, and fill it with champagne. Pink gin champagne cocktail.
That we're calling Pandora's Box.
Pandora's Box. So,
and box is a double entendre, by the way.
It means both a square container and a form of ritualized fighting.
It's a triple entendre.
I'm not sure what the third one is. Chin chin.
Chin chin.
Okay, what should we read next?
Let's head on down to the basement and find out.
Alrighty.
Clump, 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 clump. Well, here we are in the basement.
Here we are in the basement.
You've been doing lots of preserving while I've been gone, haven't you?
I have.
I see pickles and pig's feet.
Pig's feet, yep. Over
jam,
there.
Jam, various jams.
Over there I have some squirrels. And that right there is a dog.
So, what should we read?
Well, do you have any suggestions? I always have lots.
I don't know anything about the book, but the guy who wrote Let the Right One In.
Oh yeah, he's got a.
He has another book.
He has a zombie book.
That I just picked out of out from the library, but I can't remember the title.
Well, I can find it.
And I was gonna read it anyway.
Sure.
So, because we haven't read the Right One In, have we?
Nope.
No.
Nope. Yeah, here it's was the guy's name Lindqvist. So the next book is the Lindqvist novel that is not Let the Right One In. Just check the website. We'll have the title up there. I could get up and Google it, but I'm just comfortable right here. So. Great. Let's do that then.
All right. I can't believe you wouldn't get up and Google that title.
I'm not going to Google that title. Check the website.
You've been sort of lazy this whole podcast.
I've been very lazy. it's been a very busy day.
How has it been busy?
Well, I've been making decisions.
Oh yeah, your brain, your poor little brain.
Well, there you go. Yeah. So, so you've been reading anything interesting otherwise lately?
No, I really haven't had much of a chance.
Really? Bummer.
I've been doing this damn book.
Really? I've read a bunch of stuff lately. Read a great new novel called Ready Player One, which if you were a teenager in the 80s, as I was, the book was filled with all kinds of groovy 80s geek nostalgia, I have to say that the fact that I didn't get like all of the jokes or the references tells me that I didn't waste my entire youth. I only got about 80 or 90% of them. So 10% not wasted youth. Everything else was Dungeons and Dragons and video games. and there are the sequel to The Magicians, the Lev Grossman's book.
Oh, how was that?
It was pretty good.
Was it?
It was pretty good. And I hear that they're going to turn it there. It's been optioned for a television series.
Which?
The first one. Oh. Yeah, the series.
Oh, the whole thing.
Yeah, because, you know, the second book will just goes, keeps going.
Oh, they're such hateful characters, though.
I know, it'll be a great HBO series. But I'm not sure if HBO...
Oh, good, HBO, but if it went on, like, ABC or something,
yeah,
it would suck.
Yeah, no, they're, it's,
Or Showtime.
What was it described as, like, Harry Potter meets Less Than Zero?
I think it's, like, Harry Potter meets 30-something.
Possibly.
Meets Reality Bites.
Yeah, no, but the sequel was pretty good. It was pretty good. You get to hear sort of another side of the story, and plus advancing, you know, the story from where you left the characters at the very end. So
really, what was left to be advanced?
There's nothing. See, that's the thing. That's why it's part of why it's so brilliant, because they literally, you know, he gets everything he wants. He's happily ever after.
And
he's a king.
And he's bored out of his mind.
And he's bored out of his mind.
Yeah.
And his boredom leads him to make some typically bad decisions, and hijinks ensue. All
right.
Hijinks and eviscerations.
Well,
that's what I
that's
got.
Enough.
That's what I got.
And it's more than enough.
That's way more than enough.
Let's stuff it in a sack. No, let's.
Let's
sacrifice
let's
it.
Let's sacrifice it.
Let's
bury it under concrete.
And then dig up its bones 70 years later. And
put it in a Chivas Regal sack and and go tripping down the sidewalk with it.
All right.
That's good.
Cha-la-la-la.
Bye.
I forbid you.
she's gone to her father, as fast as go can she. Well, then spoke her father dear, and he spoke meek and mild. Oh, and alas, Janet, he said, I think you go with child. Well, if that be so, Janet said, myself shall bear the blame. There's not a knight in all your hall shall get the baby's name. For if my love were an earthly knight, as he is an elfin grey, I'd not change my own true love for any knight you have. Bridle ring, she heeded what he did say. And-